level, so I'll just start recording.
Okay. So there we are.
We're going.
So we're just going to start out. I'm supposed to, like, get a lot of information about your work and your background and capture your personality.
Oh, dear.
So. I don't know. I'm supposed to do that.
The good part. You just get the good part.
So we'll start with, how long have you lived in Santa Fe?
I have been here since 1990.
And did you move here to do the graduate program at St. John's?
I moved here. I came here in the summer of 89 to do the graduate program. And then I went back to Boston, where I was living at the time. And after about one day, I realized that I wanted to move to Santa Fe. And so I gave 8 months notice at my job that I was doing there, working for a nonprofit art center. And that June basically sold everything I owned, packed up a little car and moved to Santa Fe, finished the program at St. John's, and then just opened myself to life to see what would happen.
And what did you think you were going to do after getting your graduate degree?
I had not the foggiest idea. I hoped that the fates would guide me.
But you knew you wanted to stay here.
I knew I wanted to stay here partly because it was just so horribly noisy in Boston, and it was so quiet here. And you could hear yourself think. When I was at St. John's, I did quite a lot of my reading on the top of Monte Sol. I just take my books up there, and it was a wonderful place to think. And there's something about being in nature and being under the sky and watching the lizards and all of those things that somehow makes the experience, I think, of reading the St. John's curriculum all the more rich.
How long have you been doing the Radio Cafe?
9 years.
And how did you get that job?
Well, that's also a sort of odd story. I, shortly after I moved here, got fanatically interested in salsa music and salsa dancing. And it really led me to all sorts of places, including Havana, Cuba, and Matanzas, and Mexico, and Peru. And I learned Spanish, and I amassed a huge salsa CD collection and became a DJ at a club that is no longer here called the Paramount. And I did Latin night there for several years. And then I had been listening to the Salsa Sabrosa show on KUNM and decided to join the Raíces Collective and become a salsa DJ on KUNM. And I did that. And then there was a show which still exists and which I still DJ called Somos Son, which is on Saturday afternoons on KSFR, that a wonderful guy named Fernando Mayans, who was teaching Spanish at the Santa Fe Community College, had started and gotten a lot of discs together for that show, and he was hosting it. And so I started hosting it, and then I started working part-time at the radio station as a tech. And I did that for about a year and a half and doing administration and things like that. And then this job came open, and I just felt really strongly that I should do it. And I got the job and have been doing it ever since.
Mm-hmm. And is this your full-time job, or do you do other things?
No, I do other things, but this is it.
Oh, that's good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, so my next actual question was, because I know you write for Huffington Post and a couple of other things, so can you give me a rundown of, like, other things that you do? I know that you work with Lannan, or you were on the Cultural Freedom series.
I did. I hosted a couple of events for the Lannan In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom series, and I hosted and had a conversation with, the way they do that Reading in Conversations series, Maria Hinojosa, the wonderful Latina journalist, and Michael Ratner, the constitutional lawyer who is currently defending Julian Assange. That was a great honor. I love the Lannan Foundation and all the things they do. Just parenthetically, I don't do a whole lot of other paid work. I do, you know, I host panel discussions and things like that, but I've done a little bit of freelance writing off and on, but basically this job takes up a lot of time.
Yeah,
because I'm on 5 days a week and it's an hour a day, and I don't really have a producer or an editor or anything like that, and I do my own sound and all of that, so it's a wonderful time consuming job.
What drew you to St. John's for graduate school? You went to Yale as an undergraduate?
I went to Yale undergrad.
What did you study there?
I was an art history major, which I kind of fell into, but worked out okay. I wasn't very good at it. And then I came to St. John's 89 through 91.
And what drew you, though? Like, why were you interested in St. John's?
What happened was I was living in Boston, and I was actually the general manager of a little nonprofit art space called Mobius, which is a wonderful place. And being the general manager of that small organization means that basically you are doing everything. You're writing grants, you're putting pictures up on the wall, you're sweeping the floor, you're getting posters laminated, you're trying to find the best deal on something, you're doing it yourself because you can't afford to do it. And after some years, and it was a wonderful place, and I made lifelong friends there, and I learned a tremendous amount about art and about the art community. But after a while, I realized I hadn't had my own thoughts for a while. I hadn't been reading books and thinking about them and talking about them, and I felt this gap in my life. Like, I didn't know who I was or what I was doing because I was just so busy. And a friend of mine who was kind of a half a generation older than I had gone to St. John's in the 1970s and loved it and was always talking about it and had encouraged me to go there. And I just thought the time has come. And I took an 8-week leave of absence from that job and went to St. John's. And it was a very beautiful, quiet, introspective summer for me. It was a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you think that your St. John's experience helps you in your work here?
I think, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, St. John's it should be required vocational training for anybody who wants to be a talk show host, I swear. Because you are working with ideas all the time. You learn, for example, when I went to St. John's, I then went back to Boston and I read the newspaper and I read the same magazines that I'd always read. And I realized that the roots of political arguments that I was reading about were rooted centuries and sometimes millennia back, and that I could identify what they were and understand them more deeply through my reading at St. John's. And that was tremendously valuable. The ability to actually shut up and listen to somebody else, which I guess I was probably reasonably good at, but I got a lot better at it at St. John's, that is also very helpful. Being able to both read closely and in detail and get the big picture are skills that you learn at St. John's that are really important if you're doing this kind of journalism. What else? And I think also, especially at the Graduate Institute, you get exposed to so many different kinds of people. You get to know different kinds of people. In that, especially the first year for some reason, there were people of all ages. It wasn't just people who were a year or two out of college and weren't quite sure what they wanted to do, so they go get their master's at St. John's in liberal education, which is fine. But there were several monks and nuns there. There were teachers there. There was the owner of a fast food chain who had very strong ideas about capitalism and talked about them, and people argued with him. And there were some great arguments. There were housewives. There were all kinds of people. And finding out what they had to say and learning to really listen to them and respect them and bring the conversation forward, that was amazing.
Two clarification points. Did you do the Western program?
Yeah, they didn't have the Eastern yet. Yeah.
And then where are you originally from?
I'm originally from Poughkeepsie, New York.
Oh, okay. And how was that for you growing up?
My parents were both college professors. My dad taught at Vassar College until he died, and my mother taught at Bard College for many years, and then later, when I was in college, taught at Colgate University. And especially in those days, being a kid on a college campus was the ultimate freedom, because unlike today, there were no cell phones. Your parents never asked where you were. You would just go out in the morning and come home in the evening, or maybe come home for lunch. And you had the run of a 2,000-acre college campus. You could make all sorts of friends among the students. There were all sorts of facilities and candy machines. And my parents had and lakes, and the daffodils came out every spring. And, you know, it was paradise, really, for a kid. And my parents, and I was an only child, and my parents had a lot of friends who were professors and just interesting people, and students came over to the house, and, excuse me, I got interested in ideas then, and I often found kids my own age to be kind of uninteresting in comparison to adults. Do you need a napkin?
Yeah. I'm okay.
There's one in the closet here if you need it. Okay, good. So, it was great.
Cool. How do you prepare for your show? Like, how many books a week do you have to read? For instance, I was listening to the podcast of yesterday's show, the interview about working, and, you know, did you sit in on a rehearsal?
Yeah.
Or?
If there's a play, I will go to the rehearsal. If there's a movie, I'll get the DVD screener or go to the press screening. If there's a book, I'll read it. If there's a social service agency, I'll Google it. So it basically, I mean, I think the best way to honor your guest and your audience is to prepare. And very few times I have been less prepared than I wanted to be. And it usually came out okay, but it's not ideal.
Mm-hmm. How does it feel like does it ever get tense? Like, there's a couple of questions that I had, like for instance, you had to correct, I think, the director of working on a historical.
I feel bad about that.
Right, on historical fact, and I'm not trying to pick on her, but just sort of in general, like, when you have to do that, is that a moment of tension, or, like, is it hard to keep focus when you get distracted by stuff like that, or?
It happens very rarely. There was a moment where an author who was on the air thought that sonar was the same as x-rays. And at that time in my life, I was carrying around a copy of the electromagnetic spectrum in my purse, which is super nerdy, but there we have it. And after this, I corrected her on the air, and she sounded sort of confused. But afterwards, I showed it to her and gave it to her, and she thought I was completely weird. But, you know, that day there were some scientists listening, and they were glad that we corrected that and that people didn't think that sonar and x-rays were the same thing. And I thought, how could she possibly think that? And then I realized that it comes from imaging. You have x-ray imaging in the hospital, and you have ultrasound imaging in the hospital. And because that was how she connected, I figured that was how she connected them. So, but it happens very rarely.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody, how do you know, or how did you learn to sort of jump in if somebody's rambling, or how do you know when they're sort of going to get to a point? Like, how did you develop those instincts?
Have I?
How do you?
Have I done it?
I assume that you have developed those instincts.
I don't know. What do you think? Do you listen to the show?
A little, sometimes. It's always smooth. It always feels smooth. That's why I'm asking.
I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe it's a St. John'sians thing. I mean, at St. John's, when somebody is rambling, the tutor always has the choice of gently cutting them off or letting them finish. And in that context, you don't really want to cut people off if they're developing a thought. But on the other hand, you want to have good audio, have good radio. So I don't know. I don't think I cut people off all that much. I think what happens is if you ask good questions, they get really engaged and focused and tend not to ramble that much.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably what it is.
Are people ever kind of like really nervous to go on the radio? Do you have to do anything to like make people comfortable?
Yes. Sometimes they're nervous. And the fact that this is in a coffee shop makes it easier, because if they actually say, I'm really nervous, I've never been on the radio before, you say, well, it's just a chat over coffee. Let's get some coffee. And then during the sound check, before you go on the air, you kind of make them laugh. And I often ask them about their animals, and most people have animals, and they love to talk about their animals. And then you just engage them for a little while, and by the time you get on the air, you've established some comfort with one another, and it usually goes okay. Every once in a while, somebody's super nervous, but it doesn't happen. It usually works out. And you know what? This is local radio. So if it's not perfect, so what? This is a member of our community. So the member of our community is nervous, but they're talking about something which is important. Maybe they're talking about an agency that helps runaway teens. So they're a little nervous. You still hear it, and maybe the nervousness comes from never having done it before because they've been out in the field working. So I've learned not to be a perfectionist doing this work, and I think not being a perfectionist is a good thing, because life isn't perfect and people aren't perfect, and there's a whole world of characters and human beings and spirits and souls that need expression, and you just get them on the air and wonderful things happen.
Have you ever had any mishaps on air? Like, have you completely lost your train of thought, or had a guest say something that struck you so much you cried, or anything like that?
Yes, one time they were playing, there were some musicians, and they were either, I can't remember, it was a long time ago, it's not on the podcast, they were either singing a song or reciting a poem that was so sad. It was so beautiful and so sad that tears came out, and they saw me, and so they just started talking. And I regained my composure.
So you said you speak Spanish. Do you speak any other languages?
I speak German. Okay. My mom's German.
So you learned it in the home or in high school? Or?
In the home, in high school, and then from visiting relatives in Germany. And I studied first for a semester in Germany.
Mm-hmm. What does your mom think of your career?
Oh, she's the proudest mother ever. In fact, we go around, and she basically, like, the other day, she heard somebody talking about the radio cafe, and she said, well, I'm Mary Charlotte's mother.
She's very proud.
She's very proud. She thought I was never going to amount to anything. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't put that in, but...
You have all this, like, really good schooling, it sounds like.
Well, the thing is, you know, you go to Yale, and they expect you to be somebody. And do you know Max? Max, come here and meet Jennifer. Here. No. Okay, a little digression. Back to work. Go ahead.
Okay. So how do you feel about being... This is like the weird questions about the mayor's award and celebrity, but how do you feel being like a Santa Fe celebrity? Is that hard in a small town? Because you kind of are. Like, certain people in the media become, you know, known, sort of.
Right.
Like, is it hard to go to the movies, or are people just always pitching you, or, you know what I mean?
You know, how do I answer that? I really like it. I like the fact that the show is known, because the show is public service. You're basically introducing members of the community to each other. Mm-hmm. And it's not that everybody is from the community, but usually people who are on the, not always, but you know, usually people who are on the show are people who are either visiting or doing something in town or have written a book and they're going to speak at the bookstore or something like that. And the fact that occasionally people will recognize me or stop me in a public event or something like that makes me happy, because it means that they're listening. And one time I was at an event with name tags, and a scientist from Los Alamos saw my name tag, and he said, ah, Mary Charlotte, you're my cultural multiplier. I had the same reaction. What? And I said, what do you mean? He said, I can't go to everything, but I can listen to your show, and so I learn so many more things that I'm able to actually go to myself, and it's wonderfully helpful for me. And all right, I'm a cultural multiplier.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, people will behave as if they know me, but I don't know them. And so they'll touch me or come up a little too close in my face, and that can be slightly irritating. But I'm glad I'm not on television, because on radio you have a lot more anonymity, because most people don't know what you look like unless they go to the podcast site or have seen you at an event or something like that. So I was more of an introvert as a kid, and when I moved here for all the years before I was doing the show, I felt like I was the one who observed other people, but nobody knew anything about me. And so it's a little bit odd to be somebody who more people know me than I know them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of the job. And I'm very happy and honored to receive the Mayor's Award, because it's the first time they've given it to anybody in radio.
Oh.
And they always give the award to people in the arts, and they've given it to wonderful people this year. And then they always have one for a supporter of the arts, and sometimes it's a philanthropist. Last year it was Dorothy Massey of Collected Works Bookstore, who's fabulous and who I work with closely. I'm quite sure they haven't given it to anybody in radio before, and so I feel happy on behalf of myself and my station and my entire medium.
Mm-hmm. So, two more questions. Mm-hmm. One, this leads naturally into, like, you know, there's trouble in, you know, radio, and the, like, the business of radio is very threatened by various things. So, you know, like, DJ-less radio stations, some things like that. How do you feel the state of public radio is in Santa Fe? Like, you know, how do you think it's going?
I mean, judging from our support, we have a lot of people who listen to radio in Santa Fe. The death knell of radio has been sounded every decade since the invention of television. And I don't think it's going anywhere. Whether it will change forms, whether there will be less AM, FM, more satellite, more podcast, really remains to be seen. A lot of that kind of thing depends on what is standard equipment in cars. Mm-hmm. As long as there are AM and FM radios in cars, people are going to listen to them. But people love radio, and in Santa Fe, people seem to love community radio. And they know each other, and they know the radio people, and they care about local news, and they find out what's going on about it. They listen to the city council meetings. They really listen to KSFR. So I don't know the demographics of our listenership. I know that my show is pretty widely varied in terms of demographics just because of the people who approach me. But in general, it may be true that public radio has fewer younger listeners than it used to. And when you look at, for example, All Things Considered, the people who are anchoring that, a lot of them, and reporting, have been around 20, 30, 40 years. So their audience has grown up with them. And what the next generation of public radio listeners is like, I do not know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you want to talk about your attempts at syndication, or do you want to leave that out of this?
Yeah, I'll talk about it.
Okay.
Is this too long?
No, I mean, I just basically record, like, I have one more question after this. And
okay.
We're just going to be another couple minutes.
I have, for years, been told that I should try to syndicate, that's right. Doesn't matter, it's not going in the air. I've for years been told that I should try to syndicate the radio show, and of course that's not really possible because a lot of it is local. But lately I've thought that it might be a good thing to syndicate one day a week, and we have chosen to really focus on promoting a science-based show, a science show. And the reason is, there are several reasons for that. One is that everybody thinks of Santa Fe as this culture city, but it's also really a science city. We've got the Santa Fe Institute here, we've got Los Alamos, we've got a lot of science people, active and retired, who are here. We've got the Santa Fe Alliance for Science, which is doing work in the schools and has had a tremendously positive effect on the schools and science fairs and science literacy and things like that. And in the country right now, in newspaper journalism, there is a loss of science journalism. A lot of science sections have closed down and things like that. And so there's a real need for science journalism, but there's especially a need for science journalism which focuses on, first of all, really making shows that regular people can understand. And much as I carry around the electromagnetic spectrum and things like that, there's, you know, you can't do nerdy shows and think that people are going to listen. They really have to be about ideas, which is where my St. John's background, I feel, is very helpful, because you can, whatever scientists you're talking to, you can really get at the big ideas that are driving their work and that are inherent in their work. And I think there's a need for that because we live in a world that is so dependent on scientific innovation, and we are so... somebody was saying some very large percentage of our gross domestic product is dependent on an understanding of quantum mechanics. In other words, all these computers that we're using, to record this conversation and everything else, wouldn't be here if we didn't understand these things. And most of us don't, not that I want to make everybody understand quantum mechanics, because I don't particularly understand quantum mechanics, but there are so many things that it would really behoove us to understand. And so that is what we're working toward right now. And so maybe someday soon there will be a science radio cafe, which is what we're calling it, that can be heard beyond KSFR.
Wow.
We shall see.
Wow, that took the interview in this whole other good direction. And the final question is, what are some of your personal favorite pursuits, you know, in terms of reading or hobbies or things that you like to investigate?
I was for many years majorly into salsa dancing. Probably majorly isn't really a word, is it? Heavily into salsa dancing. And salsa music, and I used to go to Havana all the time and study dance and music and do shows on it and things like that. And I still love that music, but I haven't been dancing nearly as much as I want to. I have 3 dogs, and I spend a lot of time walking them. This job is so consuming that I don't really have any major hobbies anymore. I think a lot of what I do on the show is what people would do in their spare time, like read books and go to the movies and go to the theater. I get to do it for work, and therefore after work I don't really want to go do that much more of it. I actually just want to chill out and stay home and see friends and lie on the couch and watch South Park.
That's an excellent last quote. We'll go with that.
Okay, good. Are we done?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That was great. Thank you.